Well, I have to quote your mother and say those two words. Thank you for the incredible journey you took us on in this just amazing one-woman show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to watch.
Oh, my word. Could you have imagined, could young Jeanette Magruder have imagined this journey that you have been on?
No, I could not. No, I could not. It was created out of choices, conscious and unconscious. And it was navigated by a grace.
What's wonderful about it is it pulls together all of your many talents in storytelling, acting, singing, and all of them come together to make us feel like we're not just in a room with Satori, but in all of these people that she has encountered over the course of the last several years. You bring them all to life so much.
Oh, thank you for saying so. That's what I had hoped to do.
Your mother sounds to me like she was an incredible force of nature.
She was, although in the early years, because of our being on different opposite sides of coming into womanhood and going into her stage of perimenopause, losing those reproductive abilities, and me coming into it, was often we were clashing. So I couldn't appreciate a lot of the things that she offered. But as I grew older, and I could appreciate exactly the strength, the courage that she had, and we became friends, which afforded me the opportunity to really get to know her on another level, and for me to be fully expressed with her. Because, you know, when you have this status, mother-daughter, you often don't mature. Sometimes I tell younger women, sometimes you have to wean your mothers like a baby. You have to wean that mothering, controlling status thing and see, can you be women together as well?
I feel like there are a lot of people who need to be weaned off that controlling status.
Yes. All of us, I would say.
When did you discover your many talents, and was it the singing that came to you first? Was it your ability to act and portray characters?
It was being exposed to these old, semi-educated Black women from the Alabama, Mississippi, Jim Crow South, who spoke the language of storytelling, which I often refer to them as having masters and PhDs. So they would tell stories, but not only would they tell stories, they'd become everything in the story, from the frog to the bird, to the click, 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 click of the heels, to the voices. And because we were kids and they were trying to make it live for us, and that was just how they did it. So I learned how to do that, but singing came first. And it wasn't that I discovered it. I don't think that we discover it. I think that we do it, and then somebody else points it out as something. Other than that, we're just being. So my stepmother, who told me a lot of stories, taught me songs as we sat on the front porch rocking back and forth on the glider in warm, good weather. And when I went to the second grade, the teacher said, "Who knows a song?" And I raised my hand, and she said, "Okay, stand up and sing the song." And I sang, "There'll be bluebirds over." And the kids clapped, and clapping was new. "What's that? Why?" And then I went to my next class. A note came, "Come to the library. Can you sing that same song?" "There'll be blue," more clapping. "Well, this is new." And so it was like the kids and the teacher discovered, oh, she can sing. So I got in chorus, which was validating from the teachers. And then I got in a singing group. This is Motown. And I majored in voice because I took ownership. Okay, I can sing. But then when I got with P-Funk, because my teachers at university said, you can sing better than 90% of all people. And I said, really? What is that? Great, that sounds good to me. When I got into P-Funk, I realized who the other 10% were.
For anybody who hasn't seen the film or doesn't know the story yet, how did you become one of the Brides of Funkenstein?
I moved to New York to record an album and a solo album, and the producer made off with the master tapes and the money that was put up to do it. So I was in New York. I wasn't going to go back to Detroit, so I started auditioning for Broadway. And then a childhood friend of mine, who was no longer a child but happened to live in New York, was doing album covers for P-Funk, the great Overton Lloyd. And he had come by to drop off Funkentelechy versus the placebo syndrome. And I never even took the cellophane off. But then he's, because I was a snob, I was jazz and classical. And so he said, there's an audition in Detroit for this new group called the Brides of Funkenstein. I ripped off the cellophane and started listening, and I was blown away. I got the money, I borrowed the money, went to Detroit, got hired. And a week later, I was standing on stage in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in front of 10,000 people. So I kind of got my PhD in live performance, the road in being, because I got into P-Funk at the very height of their celebrity and fame. So we're talking, Marriott hotels, and we're talking people chasing our limos and autographs and costumes and New York City and all of that. And so I learned a lot, and I met the geniuses. I met the Bernie Worrells, who were Juilliard trained, and the Gary Scheider, who was a genius from Georgia, picked that get that guitar and could sing that country kind of gospely kind of sound, and the Jessica Cleaves and the Felipe Wins and the Sly Stones and all every Bootsies and the all of these people coming from all these different places in the world, in the United States, and bringing all these influences that of music, and George sort of putting in a slow cooker and blending it all together and calling it funk.
And you go from there and the magic that was P-Funk to all of a sudden finding yourself in a relationship with a child and finding yourself not sure that you want to be a part of either one of those situations.
Right, well, when Atlantic Record pulled the Brides contract and the P-Funk empire collapsed, I lost my identity. It wasn't the first time I lost my identity, but this was the first time I lost my identity. If I wasn't a Bride of Funkenstein, who was I? And so I got married, I had a child, and I went through postpartum depression. Again, who am I? So I decided to leave all of that, the music, all of that, and pursue a spiritual life, follow a guru to Hawaii, to the island of Oahu, and forget that past. However, you cannot amputate God-given gifts, and you cannot suppress true passion and desire. You can try, but it'll leak through the cracks like grass will push up through concrete. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to act. So I did all the community theater there was to do in Hawaii. I took all the private voice lessons. And then one day I woke up after having done a close-up toothpaste commercial and had money from the commercial. I decided I was going to move to Los Angeles, get on a big, bigger stages where I discovered stand-up comedy as a real true form of self expression. I knew who I was on stage, but I learned who I was I learned who I could be. I learned how to tell stories through humor. I learned how much fun and how much fulfillment I had in bringing people to laughter, because I love laughter and I love surrounding myself with laughter. And to be able to cause it was absolutely extraordinary. I knew people always laughed around me, but I think everybody's funny. And at that time, I'm still a mother. I'm separated from my child by my own choice. I'm still grieving the loss of being a Bride of Funkenstein. So to be able to find stand-up comedy and cause laughter was a form of grace to me.
And the great deal of humor in Confessions of a Menopausal Femme Fatale. And a lot of it takes place in Hawaii when you find out that your guru is just a guy. And
Guy.
poor Larry. Larry is the object of a great deal of well-deserved humor in the story.
He is, he is. But again, it leads me to the question, who am I?
And you found that, and then when you returned, you found your family again, and then in just an incredible turn of events that is so powerful and so gut-wrenchingly poignant. First, the loss of your mother, and how heartbreaking that would be when you would come to a point where you were, going back to what you were saying earlier, you had found that place where you were equals.
Yes. Well, I won't ever say I was equal to my mother, but I will say we became friends in which we both could learn from each other, but I would never, never think of myself as ever wiser than her or even equal to her. We existed as women who could share intimate things about ourselves, whereas mother-daughter, that was kind of not allowed in that status dynamic, you know?
And then before you could even process that loss, the loss of your son Noah.
Oh, yes. But first, the tragic accident that he suffered, and those 9 months, and then subsequent few years of him being a little different. Because of the head injury and having to get to know him differently as this new person who spoke differently or had to pause before he could grab the words. But often the word he was already a rapper poet, but like the words he would substitute for like for mo mosque, he called that praying house. And I often thought praying house sounds, it's got a flow to it, a beautiful song to that phrase. It's sudden. And because he was Muslim, he had to be buried within 24 hours. So that didn't even give me a chance. It didn't. And then there's a ritual where the men bathe his body. So it was so sudden and so little time to say goodbye.
And that absolutely heartbreaking moment when you met your granddaughter, I believe it's Olivia, for the first time.
Yes. It was like another moment of grace because she looked just like him, and she was like just turning 4, so she was so innocent, and I and for just that reason, she helped lift me up from the depths of overwhelming grief. I had to live for her. I had to show up because I had to get to know her and her sister and brother and her mother. So I had this whole family I had to get to know and navigate this grief and be on stage performing in menopause the musical, having to perform. And so it was going to a grief support group was really necessary and needed. And I encourage people who have lost anything they find significant to go, because I was there and people were going around sharing who they lost, and there was no one in my group, support group, that had lost a child. But when we got to this one woman, this Korean woman, she talked about losing her brother, but then she talked about losing her bird, which I thought it, at first was very funny. But as she started to talk about this bird, I got to see how connected she was with this bird. And she said, even though she lost her brother, the bird was more dear to her. And so I saw that loss in any form, if it's a pet, you know, it shouldn't be diminished. For that person, it's a relationship.
The film concludes, well, I don't want to say an ending, a happy ending, but with a transition and another door opening for you.
Yes, and I do. I mean, it's a new beginning that I enter into happy and at peace, and now can move into a future where I'm at peace, I'm happy, the past is rolled up like a carpet behind me, and now the future is just blank and I can create anything I want.
So Tori, what do you hope people take from your journey?
Well, I hope that what people take from my journey is my message is tell your story. Tell your story, be open, be vulnerable, be honest, because storytelling at the end of the day is a service. It's a service you provide to other people, to one listener or thousands of listeners, because what you're doing is saying, I'm human, I forgive myself, I'm forgiving myself in front of you, and in my forgiving of me, you're automatically forgiven. And so tell me your story.
And go back before there was film, before there was television, media of any kind, as far back as we go, those stories are what have bound us together as human beings.
Absolutely. It breaks down every barrier imaginable. And it is the most effective delivery system of information and ideas. It is probably the most powerful tool of communication.
Well, with that in mind, can you tell us a little bit about the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers?
Yes, well, the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers was a brainchild. And it came about after Wall Street had crashed. I'd put all my stuff in storage, and I basically was a bourgeoisie homeless, staying at my sister's first and then in the basement of a friend. And one morning I came up to her garden, and I'm sitting there, and I was thinking, after having toured the country with the moth, and discovering, oh, I'm a storyteller. This is my purpose. It's a service. And I was just coming back from 6 years of grief and loss for my mother and son. And I recognized that storytelling was healing me. Just telling my story of grief and loss was healing me. And I was getting support from others, other mothers and parents who had lost children. That's rare, but collectively, if you think about a podcast going global, you're getting all these emails and you're being validated and you have a whole community. And so I thought, well, if storytelling could heal me, I asked the artist in me, could it heal the city of Detroit? So I created a platform with no money. But as an artist, you don't think linearly. You start where you are. So if you have no money, you start where you are. So I started with the story, and then selling tickets in advance, 45 seats sold out. Every month we had to move to a bigger venue. And now we're back at the beautiful Charles Wright Museum of African American History in the center of the cultural center. We have had the late, great Dick Gregory on our show, George Clinton, Michael Collier, Dr. George Faison, who choreographed The Wiz and other things. We've had senators, mothers, every walk of life on our platform. And each of them I coach with the storytelling, because I discovered everyone has this gift of wisdom to share. in a story, but everybody doesn't know how to tell their story. And so I had to show people, facilitate, and that grew me into facilitating workshops for universities, faith-based organizations, governmental organizations, you name it, individuals, you name it. And so that's another mission. We have a global mission to connect humanity, heal and transform community through the art and craft of storytelling. And not only that, we're developing listeners, because storytelling, when told right, it's an art, it's a craft, but it's a science.
Yes.
The brain engages with storytelling. And so therefore you want to stay with the teller. And so I believe storytelling is, where listening is a revolutionary act. And at the highest level, it's love, because you have to give something up to truly listen to another person. And you have to give up your judgments, your assessments, your I agree, I don't agree. You have to give all that up and be over there in the life of that storyteller. And you come out having lived them, and you connect in some way to some aspect of their story. And all of a sudden, you can go back to your judgments and assessments, but oftentimes you don't.
Oh, I love that. I work with high school actors, and I tell them the best thing we do is to tell stories, and also tell them the most important skill in acting is what you just said, listening.
Yeah.
Being present, being in that moment.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well,
yes.
Confessions of a Menopausal Femme Fatale, a remarkable, poignant, and powerful story. It's such a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and thank your listeners for the opportunity to share.